The first question that I actually have for you today is, what do you see when you see that? Amy.
Well, that's the module title, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, I don't really know.
Well, that's good. I mean, a bit more.
Is that like the whole thing that we're doing today?
Just tell me what you see, what sort of messages come across.
What, from just community engagement?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, there's something else there as well.
Textual analysis. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Joe.
I don't really have a question.
What do you see when you see that? What sort of things does it say to you?
The way communities engage with each other.
You're overthinking it. But, and you could say, which is the most important, community engagement or textual analysis? Hands up if you think textual analysis. Hands up if you think community engagement. Olivia, you haven't put your hand up at all. What do you think?
Yes, because I'm trying to get my Word document open. I'm not really sure.
Well, the essence of what we're about here is, what do things mean when they're actually put into publication, print, and so on. In other words, what we're actually talking about is what's under the surface. You know, we might see something which says community engagement, but everybody in this room, if we had time, would have a different definition of what community engagement happens to be. Traditionally, seeing community engagement in big letters, as opposed to the slightly smaller textual analysis, might have suggested community engagement is more important. And actually, in this sense, yes, the message I was attempting to convey, using just those particular letters and the particular size, is that textual analysis is a subset. It's part of the rhetoric if you're looking for the theory. If you're looking for selecting this as a theory to use to underpin one of your particular analysis, this session is going to be focusing very much on textual analysis. And we will take you through the death of the author. We will take you through 1984. We will take you through colour. We'll even introduce you to Roland Barthes. Is that a bargain or is that a bargain? That's worth £100 of anybody's money. Could you actually pay into my account, please, Bobby? Thank you.
It's too soon.
All right, fair enough. But what we're actually getting here is this whole notion of what's under the surface. Because clearly we've already looked this term at things like group psychologies. We've looked at things like personas using Bobo. We've looked at ways in which that's been used to develop interest. We've looked at nudge theory. What we're looking at today is basically how are those things working. What is a really fun exercise relating to things such as what it actually says. So actually translating on the basis of whatever language you're using, be that English, be that American English, be that French, be that Chinese, etc. That's the kind of things that we're actually seeing. Who is the text speaking to? So who is the target audience? And why is that important in terms of knowing what's coming through from that point of view? Also, why is it saying what it's saying? So again, it's the message in terms of what's underpinning the message. If you are actually getting connected with X, Y, or Z project, why is it actually being aimed at you? And what's the intended effect? Now, the difference, and this is a common problem that many students face, is what's the difference between effects and affects, and when do you use them appropriately? Paige, would you like to tell me?
Yes.
That's the way. Yeah.
So, effect.
Yes.
Is the
I don't know.
Google. You've got it.
That's effect. Effect is like.
It's a consequence, isn't it?
Think of it as E for exit. Effect is what you see actually going out. It's what actually happens. The affect is how it kind of internalizes and works through that process. Difference between effects and affects, very critical in terms of that.
It's very confusing, though.
In other words, how is it working through? And when you're talking about the effects of textual analysis, part of the fun thing about this is actually everybody's opinion can be equally valid. If I say the colour red, what do you think of, Carlotta? Red.
It's a colour, yes.
Yeah. Anything else? Red. What do you think of when I say the colour red? Red.
Red.
Chairs over there, actually. Up there. No? Joe, red.
Good.
Yeah, good. Kira. Yeah.
Like danger, passion.
Yeah, good, excellent. Emma.
Anger.
Yes.
Is it
Andrew? Yep, okay. All the pretty standard ones.
Yeah, like that's
what's
normally associated with red.
All right, passion.
Yeah, that's been said.
Did you say passion?
Yeah,
all oh, right, okay. What about the whole notion of warning? Stop lights. All of these, it's redness. There's nothing in the letters R-E-D that kind of really impact that, but it is something which relates to how we see red and so on. And everybody does it. Everybody from different cultures has got their own notion. The fact that we seem to be making some kind of contact now is because there's a general sense that we all appreciate what English happens to be in terms of the sounds that I'm making, in terms of the phrases that are actually going out there. But ultimately, what images you see, the importance, as I say, I put that up there because it is important. We all actually engage in this process. But, and this is the important PR element, if you're aware of that, being aware of it is one thing, but acting on it is another thing entirely. You need to explore the cultural references of a text to get past that surface message. So how do you actually relate to a culture where red actually might mean something completely different? You know, how things relate to that particular aspect? What are the cultural aspects that we actually are engaged with here? So we can try that, and then our brains might hurt. We can actually sort of look to see how things operate. Or we also have to engage with how the actual words that we're using, the images that we're employing, all help engagement and also help persuasion. So it's really using the rhetorical term. You know, rhetoric is basically what you're going to hear lots and lots of if you're following any of the election in the next few weeks. You're going to use lots of material, and parties are going to be using lots of material to persuade people to vote for them, and a whole range of other factors as well. That is the key element from yourselves as PR folk. What's being said, how is it being received, and also how we can change it. Actually, you could argue that that is at the bedrock of all the things we've considered so far in the semester. You know, it's ultimately how you're changing things, what's being received, and how you can change it if you need to. Sometimes you might not need to, but other times you desperately need to change things around. In other words, it's not necessarily about what you have originally in mind, it's how your thoughts are being changed. Miscommunication can be as challenging as full communication in many ways, because misunderstanding something can be much more difficult to rectify if you don't get it right. Example, Nova. Anybody ever heard of Vauxhall Nova? Everybody heard of Vauxhall? It's a car.
Yeah.
Right. A few years ago, Vauxhall actually had a brand called the Nova, which is fantastic, you think, the Vauxhall Nova. Let's sell this to Spanish people. Nova translates as doesn't go. problem. Okay, just in the name itself. All sorts of other aspects that relate to that in terms of what's being said, what's being developed, and sometimes Google Translate doesn't help. I did say I mentioned that, that's why I put it up in big words. Does anybody know anything about Roland Barthes and why his text, Death of the Author, is really important? The one bit of textual analysis which really crosses over in terms of English and English studies, English. Any ideas? Okay, well, Death of the Author basically says that once you have written your stuff, once you've posted your update on social media, once you've printed it, once you've published, frankly, it doesn't matter if you didn't intend it to have certain consequences, because the consequences that it has are up to the audience. They decide what it actually means. They decide what your text happens to be. Now, that kind of takes away from my famous triangle. Why a famous triangle? Well, I'd like you to draw a triangle, a three sort of triangle sort of shape. Doesn't matter, it doesn't have to be equilateral, it can be isosceles, any triangular shape. On one point of that triangle, I'd like you to put the word audience. Okay? On another point of the triangle, I'd like you to put the word text, T-E-X-T. And on the third and final point, I'd like you to put the word author. Because most textual analysis would work on the basis of finding out some relationship between the audience, between the author, and between the text. Death of the Author suggests you take that out completely, and all you've actually got is the text and the audience, and how they actually translate that meaning. It's not a literal death, although obviously Roland Barthes is no longer with us. Well done, Caitlin, you've done that successfully.
I mean, I don't know how to do it on the actual Word document, so I kind of improvised it. That's
okay. Good. Sort of wonky triangle, but never mind. That's what happens when you rely too much on computers, you see. Always have a notepad and pen. Honestly.
We started on here.
Okay. Caitlin, don't worry about it. Do it later. It's not an essential thing. It's important, but not vital. What we're going to talk to you now, basically, is that particular phrase there. This next few moments is going to provide you with a bit of a toolkit of things that you need to bear in mind when you want to convey certain messages and, critical point here, convince audiences that you want to think in a certain way. Okay? So, first off, let's actually go to an example. Let's go way back to Greece and this particular side of things. Aristotle, great guy. Had lots of sort of thoughts about life, the universe, and various other systems. And he actually came up with the notion of what poetry means. Poetry actually translates as making. So if you're a poet... Oh, how shall I view thee sitting there upon a log? Oh dear, oh sweet, expiring frog. The poetry there. How would you actually... Are you making that image? You're creating that image in the mind of the listener or in the mind of the reader. You're structuring it. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough buds do, etc. Dying buds are made, blah, blah, blah. It's all about how that's put together. And why are you choosing those particular words to make the sense that you want to make? Why is that so important? Why arrange them in that particular way? Why actually structure things? In poetry, it can be blank verse if you're Shakespeare. We are glad the Dauphin is so pleasant with us, his present and your pains we thank you for. When we have matched our rackets to these balls, we shall in France, by God's grace, play a set, shall strike his father's crown into the hazard. Anybody know where that's from? A special prize as well for you as well. £100 rebranded. Honestly. Sorry, no kidding. Ali's back. It's just sort of bled over to me, the messages, etc. In terms of the message, Henry V Act 2, Scene 5.
Is it Shakespeare?
It is, yes.
That was a stab in the dark.
Heroes, villains, binary opposition, structure. Having a structure, we talk about when you write an essay, when you write a report, when you put together this particular portfolio and you're doing a critique. Have a beginning, have a middle, and an end. If you start a critique at the middle, and then move to the beginning, and then move to the end, that doesn't make sense to the reader. So again, it works through even on that basis, which is one of the reasons why postmodernists would say meaning is everywhere, from plastic bottles to Apple computers to logos to everything has got a whole sense of meaning and textual elements you can work through. Here's an example of meaning taken from back in the day with respect to Apple computers and their particular take on society and so on. In 1984, here it comes. Now, when they actually produced that to obviously launch Macintosh and to go back to the whole sort of system, what it was about, you're prefiguring a number of cultural thoughts. Number one, that the audience actually know the movie or the novel 1984 by George Orwell. Number two, the fact that this is not a good thing. 1984 suggests a totalitarian society in which Big Brother, not Channel 4, Channel 5 TV series, but Big Brother is watching you, and you, and you. And you have a totalitarian control in which the last abiding image of 1984 is of a boot stamping on the face of an individual forever, totally under the control of the state. So not a happy image. The message that's coming across there is not good. Here we have a situation whereby you have a young woman, obviously, effectively, with her hammer, smashing the whole thing there and saying, this is how Apple is going to solve the whole problem. So the narrative that's said there, literally, in the background, again, you can watch it, again, is very much of the destruction of the preconception of what 1984 is in order to actually get a hold of what you've got in front of you there, the Apple Mac computer. Yay. The image that's coming across. Oops, I don't want to do it again. Thank you. Well, actually, I will play it anytime. Glorious anniversary of that. Go back to that. So, what you're getting there is an advertising message, but it's also the story that presupposes that the audience can pick up on that. It assumes certain things about the audience. If you've never read any George Orwell, if you're not familiar with 1984, if you're not connecting with the actual Olympic Games of 1984 as well, or the 1980 Olympic Games and the various other things, then it's not getting across. It could just be a case of, well, here's some random sort of images of somebody smashing a big screen. So the key thing that, from the point of view of communicators, that you need to be aware of is what is the message that you're going to put across to that whole package. And what you're trying to do in terms of the persuasion. Are you trying to assuage people's thoughts, assuage people's thoughts and actually put their minds at ease? Or are you trying to get them to buy more products or engage with the process? There's a battle between Microsoft and Apple. The whole line of that. Is it a simply commercial message? You can apply that to all of the things we've talked about from the point of view of extinction agenda, from the point of view of, you know, you guarantee that more and more companies now are trying to get on message with the green culture. not because necessarily they're full of altruistic, self-sacrificing tendencies, but because they want to make more profit, obviously. Why not? Why wouldn't you? There's another image that's probably fairly famous back in the day, in the 1920s, Metropolis, and the whole notion of New York as a wonderful skyscraper city with all sorts of exciting things. And I'm using that because ultimately this is where the roots of public relations started from. The whole likes of where characters like Ivy Lee and company are actually sort of working, promoting this. But this is obviously not New York now, although this is as New York was predicted to be back in 1926, about 2026. And here's another classic case of the Big Brother image that's coming across there. Message 111. Okay, what are the dangers of this? What are the challenges that you're faced with when you start looking at something like that? Well, it's a very simple message, but then so is education, education, education. If I said Ein Volk, Ein Land, Ein Führer, what would I be saying? Not quite. Ein Volk, Ein Land, Ein Führer. What does it translate as?
Are you German? Go on, Lisa.
See what I say.
Jawohl, Fräulein, kein Tank, yeah? Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Land, Ein Führer. Unfortunately, as say, probably most associated.
Isn't that?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But very, very effective from a PR point of view. This is one of the reasons why, perhaps tragically, rightly or wrongly, and again, as you see, if you're with me for the communications and public sphere next term, one of the concerns that Habermas actually had about this whole system was the simplicity of the message led people to buy into something which actually was quite questionable, which again brings into question the whole notion of the morals, the ethics, etc. I mean, actually, one land, ein Land, which would have been a country, one leader, would have worked. One empire, a Third Reich, different line entirely. But it's still very effective in using that persuasion that Big Brother is watching you, that notion of simple, basic assumptions. So, let's go back to that advert that we looked at. It was in 1984, and you've got two things there. You've got the one I've already alluded to, which is that one. By the way, what does dystopian mean? Emma?
Like, end of the opposite to utopia.
Yeah, exactly. Opposite of utopian. Utopian is kind of like no place, so dystopian is something where everything can be just miserable. Just very sad, very upsetting, a bit like Lincoln on a wet November day. And obviously George Orwell, who, again, Orwell wrote 1984 in 1948, and the general line is he simply reversed the last two digits because he wanted to write a critique of what he saw as the very unpalatable work that was going on in what should have been a utopian world of communism, but actually was anything but that in Soviet Russia run by Stalin at the time. But also in 1984, you've got the Olympics. Why? Does anybody know why in 1980 the Russians didn't go to America, and why in 1984 the Americans didn't go, or vice versa? Anyway, there was a clear reason. What was happening there that prevented the whole of the United States of America and the whole of the Union Soviet Socialist Republics, or basically led to them boycotting the games?
Wasn't it something to do with, like, nuclear power or something?
Like,
nuclear weapons and that kind of thing?
No,
cool.
Yeah, that's
quite
cool.
They just didn't like each other.
Not really.
Yeah,
basically, it was the ideological balance which also was triggered off by the fact that Russia, Soviet Union I should say, had actually invaded Afghanistan. And there was a big concern about that, and that led to a whole range of other sort of systems. But again, if you're going to use an ad which features a woman throwing a hammer, what does that also carry with it? Anybody tell me what the images, what were the icons of the Soviet Union flag? What is the kind of classic line? It has two particular symbols on it.
Hammer.
And?
Hammer. Sorry, yeah, flag. Let me Google that.
A shield.
Sickle. A hammer and sickle. In other words, the sickle to actually sort of gather the wheat and the shares, etc., and the hammer to basically sort of forge a whole new world empire. So actually using early female empowerment in terms of an athlete who will actually throw a hammer at a screen, destroying the totalitarian face of Big Brother, you're basically plugging into both of those kind of things for people at the time. You know, another sort of areas that you look for would be look at the AIDS commercials and the problem of big, huge, whacking great icebergs seen as problems from that. These all kind of fit into the notion of where certain campaigns work and certain campaigns you actually ask the question, what were they thinking? Now, a couple of key questions from that sort of point of view. Is that Apple campaign, is it propaganda? And is it bad if it is? Is it persuasion or is it engaging? Ooh, what? Who actually set up Apple?
Steve Jobs.
Yeah. Exactly. And on that sort of basis alone, what were their working practices? Were they ethical? Were they moral? What were the sort of lines in terms of what Jobs and Wozniak was actually doing? And actually, the history of that kind of imagery. Did it involve group psychology? Well, it was tapping into the people who would actually be seen as futurists. One of the things about Apple is it basically fetishizes its product. What do I mean by that? It fetishizes its product. Basically makes it desirable. It's the kind of thing you want to have. If you want to keep up to date, you want the latest iPod or the latest Apple computer or the various other things. Back in the day, it was iPods, etc. You'd be using those kind of things. And you kind of share the notion that this was something that was on the side of the good guys. But the other challenge that you got with an apple, what else does it say when you've got an apple with a bite out of it, if you happen to be of a certain particular ideology? Genesis, perhaps? Book of Genesis? Garden of Eden? Eve? What's Eve got to do with the apple?
Forbidden fruit.
And so you've obviously got an image of an apple there that you can see there. You can see there on the back of your Apple devices, you see there. Which is basically signifying, on the one hand, this is forbidden fruit. Now, can that be attractive? Of course it can. If you say something is wrong, you're going to want it more. So it's applying on that one as well from that point of view. And it's also raising the issue of how you're likely to work there. Now, that's just with an image, just one particular image. And from the textual analysis, you're just breaking it down in terms of why it works, how it works, and so on. So let's go back to this one again and see how this actually operates this time round. They still have the same symbol as well. Why are you confused?
That would make sense.
What is it?
It's Macintosh.
Macintosh, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's Can't
we start the one question that we all know?
Yeah,
what's that got to do?
The wrong question.
But what's that got to do with 1984?
That's the point. I wouldn't even look at that and say, oh, that's 1984.
Okay, so they've decided to make So you know the book?
No, but it's meant to be the book as well.
Yeah,
but
they're making their product into a dystopian fantasy.
No, they're saying this is why 1984 isn't going to be like 1984, the book.
Because that's going to change it all. That's not the thing I get, I just don't understand the whole.
Yeah,
I just think it's so lazy.
Yeah, Polly and I were saying it literally looks like the Holocaust. Like they've all got shaved heads, they're all wearing uniform outfits. And then they're all like marching
and then
in.
There's like massive small
gas chamber boys
in
like pajamas,
isn't it?
I get
really
what they're trying to achieve, film. I just don't like the advert.
I don't think it would go very well in one day.
No.
I mean, you can't see Alexander Meerkat really sort of fitting into the place, can you? And yet, then again, I still think one of his Meerkat's ads where certainly the two youngsters actually have their home destroyed
that's
and they
fun.
Travel over to see him.
That's
epic. But, again, going back to that whole system, can anybody remember Bubba? Where was Bubba? Did I talk about Bubba?
Texas.
Yes, litter in Texas. And when you're talking about ads in public relations, that is the challenge. Because ultimately, you're communications and public relations specialists. You're about managing reputation. So a criticism that you'd actually have about something like, as you've just said, what were Apple thinking when they were producing that particular ad, or how it was... I mean, it looked slick. It was well put together. It was developed quite nicely. It was obviously a big budget advertisement. They'd worked on that premise. But yes, it's completely dystopian. It's showing a totalitarian society, possibly echoes of the Holocaust. Certainly listening to, again, what we're hearing in terms of the ad, a whole range of other... It disconnects, possibly with the audience as well. And doing advertisements can be problematic if you just actually sort of want to use it to get the biggest effect, etc. And ultimately, that brings us to this science. The science of semiotics. Not, as some might say, half an optics. What's a semiotic? It's half an optic. But the notion of the science of signs and signifiers, the redness and so on. Cue this chap. I don't want to give too much away, but he was actually run over by a laundry van in 1980.
Grand.
A laundry van?
Absolutely.
That's a
great
to guess.
In
what's
France.
A laundry van?
Well,
a van that carries laundry.
From where to where?
From laundry to customer, maybe?
I hope they had their laundry delivered.
Oh,
bougie. Anyway, there is Roland Barthes, or at least a segment of Roland Barthes.
Why do I know this thing?
And because he's the father of semiotics. He coined the term
that's
semiotics.
He's been mentioned before.
And in fact, you actually just did a triangle, basically, which was actually his creation, the sort of audience author text triangle, has its roots in Roland Barthes. But if we actually look at the photograph I'm about to show you, language, I'd like you to actually tell me what would you say you would make up about this particular image and what we see there in terms of Roland Barthes. So give me one thought, please, Polly.
I've just been told for longer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
he
forgets in 5 minutes.
About
him. The image?
Yes, it
says donuts and bombs. Sorry, friends.
I don't
know. Olivia.
Olivia.
Oh, that's the first thing.
Yeah, no.
The cabinet organisation.
Cabinet organisation,
okay.
Eleanor?
That's what I was
going to
say.
It seems quite relaxed. Because he's got that cigarette sort of, he's like slouched in his chair and the cigarette's like hanging out of his mouth.
Yeah, okay, so relax. Joe.
I'm not sure.
Kira.
He reminds me of some kind of like philosopher or something. It's like the whole of the organization, but also. He just seems like he's drowned
himself in loads of
work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Emma?
I was just
going to
say he's a smoker.
That's fine, that's good. Could be, it's unlikely he wasn't a smoker, and if the cancer didn't get him, the laundry truck would. Lisa?
Not sure.
Carlotta?
Mm-hmm.
No? Amy?
It's quite educated.
Why would you make that assumption?
Because
because he looks like he's got all the files in the back and then the papers on the desk.
It's a classic image. Whenever you want to actually demonstrate that somebody is an academic or is intellectually gifted or in some way, shape or form, you put a stack of books or files behind them. I mean, he may well be somebody who doesn't care because of the attitude that we actually see his cigarette dangling, etc. He may be a typical French existential philosopher who has his bottle of wine, his cigarette, and realises that ultimately we're all doomed.
Quel dommage.
What semiotics is can be broken down into these six segments. Okay? First of all, it's the study and analysis. And actually, that exercise in terms of just looking at a photograph, we could have spent an entire 50 minutes on and still actually sort of probably found more rich tapestry in there if you're looking to it in terms of what's drawing out. The fact that it was in black and white, that it was in monochrome, the fact that it was suggestive of a French expressionistic era, the fact that actually the whole notion of the cigarette was again a particular culture and the signifier of either poor health habits or somebody who doesn't care, etc. But it's what we're actually seeing is those signs as signifiers. All texts, and this is where the analysis comes in. Think of analysis as splitting things apart. Synthesis is putting things back together. Analysis is basically texts are made up of words, images, or anything that you can make interpretations of. So anything that means messages, etc. Whether they be floral, whether they be plant-based, whether they be green, whether they be cultural side of things, all of these things are signed. And every sign that you see has got a signifier, which is effectively what it's saying, and also what's being said by it, a signified. Signifier, as we said there, is the physical aspect of the sign. So the signifier of table is the fact that we see the table in front of us. We don't see a collection of atoms which are mostly empty space. We see something where, you know, the actual table is solid. We know that the table is actually there. We can see the table. We can agree it's a table. Culturally, we see it's a white table. Table blanc, the L-A-N-C, table vice. You know, lying from that point of view. And the signifier, again, so it's the physical aspects of the sign. The signified is what you're thinking about there. That's when I asked you the question about redness. There's no reason why red might mean passion, danger, stop, alert, any of those things, or even a colour. It's just because culturally we've chosen to use that particular phrase to explain what it's about. In other words, it's underlined word here, the meaning. It's the meaning of that particular line that's there. And it's what is in that meaning. If you choose to actually use a black and white image, that has certain meanings. It may be seen as very artistic. It may be seen as an affectation. It may be seen as something that just looks good at the time. But again, rationalising why that's there. When you're analysing your campaigns, when you're analysing your particular aspects, and I'm going to be asking you to do this for tomorrow, think about how those meanings are developed, because together, that's what we call a whole series of sign systems. And that actually does carry with it a lot of cachet within the industry and so on. And there we have some examples, okay? We've already talked about traffic lights. That's the sign. That's what it signifies, or what physically we see, three coloured lights, red, amber, green. And what is it? What's signified by that? Well, anybody walk across on a red light? Yeah. Anybody go on green? All of those kind of things. Don't be an amber gambler. Clothes, what are they sort of relating to? What do we see in terms of uniforms? What messages go out by respect to the uniforms? How do you differentiate between a punk and a policeman? I know a policeman can be undercover as a punk. And perhaps even more importantly, we get this all the time, what are we getting when we actually do a quick scan and we see facial expressions and we see Becky basically paying no attention whatsoever? I think she's tuned out again. God, what's happened? You know, all of those sort of things, how things are developed, how we're relating to that, body language can signify all of those kind of things. So they're the kind of fundamentals that you're looking for. And when it comes down to the psychology, that's ultimately the bedrock of what these things are about. That's why I say, although textual analysis, it's not given as a specific category, you can use this right across any one of your particular theories to actually start explain how your campaigns are working. There's a good example from right up to date, really. Because obviously it's there. There's your simple slogan. Arbeit macht frei. Ein Volk, ein Land, ein Führer. There's the fact. Perhaps maybe I'm made up, etc. There's what you're looking to do. Vote leave, red bus, warning, pay attention, stop. You know, let's do it now. NHS logo slap bang in the middle there. Genius. It did its business, did its job with respect to that whole thing. And unpicking that particular sign, unpicking that image, you've got a whole range of sort of factors. And, you know, that's part and parcel of how we see the image being greater than the text in many ways, or the text that you use it. It can be words, you've got words there, but you've got it simple. Take back control, as we said. Really simple message, really effective. Look, it's led to more elections and more fun things, and another one coming through in a few weeks' time as well. Great stuff. What about that one? Folk who've been ripped off because they've actually sent off for their shopping to some sort of Asian company and they've been made members without wanting to be members. She missed it. Sorry, it's all right. It was over. Ahead. It's ignored completely.
The company was not sketchy. I'd like to just reiterate that.
Okay.
Not stupid as a lot.
In terms of the sort of message, is that what sort of things is that going to be showing to you, Amy?
They're quite original.
Original? Yeah, good. Anything else?
Different.
Yeah, yes. Anything? Okay. So, yes?
All that's making me think about is that
Victorian vampires. That's what I've got in my head.
You've got what?
Victorian vampires.
Victorian vampires, exactly. All of those things coming to the fore in terms of the look and the image that's actually there. What about that one? Presumably you might be familiar with respect to that. It's a man's bottom. Why is he actually posing that, and why is that such an iconic image that's been used by presidents, including sadly Trump, time and time again?
Wasn't it in a film or something?
Springsteen.
I know they used it in Grown Ups 2.
And Blinded by the Light, which was very
sure. It's just like that stereotypical American.
Why?
Boy, isn't it?
Why? Alright, I'll go through six reasons. Number one. Stars and stripes, okay? Number two, jeans. Number three, white T-shirt. Number four, baseball glove. Number five...
No, that's a hat.
That's a baseball glove.
That's a hat.
That is a hat.
That's a snapback.
Definitely a hat.
I think
baseball gloves are tan.
That's not a hat.
It's a hat.
That's a hat.
It is not a hat.
It's a hat.
That's a hat.
It's
a hat. Baseball gloves are tan.
I think
you're not red.
Do you want me to Google it?
Well, again, fine, yeah. But again, it's in terms of the argument thing. And, of course, silver belt, the whole sort of signifying the Western, the whole aspect of that. It's your average archetypal New Jersey system, quite apart from the text that we say they're born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen.
It's a baseball cap.
Thank you.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
It's a cap.
Completely sure, because you can see the snapback.
All right, okay, fine. Well, cap, glove, whatever. It's still signifying baseball. So all of those things put together, and this was originally obviously from the days where people would say album covers on LPs were very important because they have that, but that's become an image that's echoed across the decades and still tends to do that because it signifies Americana. It's that sort of image that comes across there. Just as the Rolling Stones have been signified by a whole range of things, and there, as we say, there's another image that comes across that also signifies Americana. And people might well say, great, you know, this is our leader. This is what it's all about. You know, it's what it's focusing on. It's how, you know, we can actually sort of get trumped on the whole sort of system. Because, and you're right, you're looking at a cap. Is that because, he's looking at, just give me a couple of seconds to actually just read through that. Because that's the speech that he actually made and think about how he's actually using the language. You know, many people actually say Trump is thick and pretty inappropriate, etc. I think it's fair to say that maybe there's a bit more depth in terms of when you see that, how he's using the notion of America. And America is synonymous with love. And America is synonymous with good things. And make America great again. And all the messages that come across from this, from the inner cities to the rural outposts, from the Sun Belt to the Rust Belt, from east to west and north to south, the movement built on the conviction that every American from every background is entitled to a government that puts their needs first. Make America great again. Put America first. Political point from that point of view, time to rebuild our country, take care of our people, fight for the jobs our great American workers deserve. And that's what they're doing. Yeah, it's not necessarily a case of hugely problematic in terms of what we see there, but it's a very effective piece of speech making which impacts again in terms of the text and the images that are actually there. First person who actually used the term America first was Charles Lindbergh, also known for the Lindbergh kidnapping case, but he was also a National Socialist, and that's what he was actually using then when he was actually arguing that America shouldn't be fussing with the likes of the socialist sort of so-and-sos in Britain, etc. They should be supporting Adolf Hitler, because he was doing great jobs in Germany. What a strange world we would have had if that was the case. But he's still using that whole notion of the language that comes across there, and where things actually emerge and so on. So, if you actually asked everybody who was at that Trump rally, did they actually know where that came from? I would pretty much guarantee, let's say 100%, but 98%, that they wouldn't. But then, what does it also say about Donald Trump? That he's actually using the same kind of rhetoric, the same kind of language, the same kind of words that connected basically with somebody who was a keen supporter of the Nazi Party. After all, Donald Trump's grandparents were German, so what's not to love? You know, he came across, he did the whole thing, etc. Why shouldn't we care about that whole side of things? That's something you might like to check out. Introduction to Communications, Robert Fisk, still really good, even though it's 2 decades old from that sort of point of view. But what I'd like you to do for tomorrow is to come to the seminar prepared to basically do some basic textual analysis on the campaigns that you're working with in. Doesn't matter what bits of piece you're doing or the campaigns that you've selected for your portfolio. I just want you to basically sort of share with the group some images and talk about what sort of messages they're conveying in terms of the signifier, in terms of the signified. And hopefully we'll get through everybody if we can move fairly briskly through the actual session. We have a good turnout, which would be great. So, signified, look for the key things for that. Anybody not understand the task I'm asking you to do between now and tomorrow? All clear? Excellent. I will see you then. Take care, and don't buy any wooden nickels.